Good morning. This is Impact Cincinnati on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Marianne Zalesnik. The major news stories that broke out in Boston and Texas last week brought lots of live on-the-scene reporting, speculating, and nonstop coverage. It also brought many complaints about the news media. This morning, we're going to talk with NPR Ombudsman Edward Schumacher-Matos. We'd like to hear your questions and comments, too. You can email them to impact@wvxu.org or post them on our Facebook page. Good morning. Thanks for joining me.
Good morning, Marianne.
I think a great place to start today is just to look back at the past couple of weeks and the coverage that NPR did provide from the Boston and the Texas situations, events, and tell me what kind of comments you were getting from people writing to you.
You know, in general, I think the comments were more positive than negative. NPR had been very careful ever since it misreported Gabrielle Giffords' shooting several years ago out in Arizona, where NPR reported that she had died, and she had not, obviously. And so since then, when these things have happened, NPR has just been very, very careful to try to be right instead of trying to be first or fast. So in that sense, the accuracy of the reporting has been pretty good. Some people complain that there's too much of it, but that's just, you know, that's a personal preference of whether you want to know a lot or you want to, you know, want to hear about something else. And, you know, some people thought that some of the stories, one story in particular looked like it was slanted to the left, criticizing that the right might be responsible for this. But if you go back and listen very closely to the story, it wasn't really saying that. So generally, I think NPR acquitted itself pretty well. But these fast-breaking events that are so hard to stay on top of always generate a lot of criticism.
What's the most important thing that you think that the reporters and the staff has to look at in a situation like a breaking news event like what happened in Boston?
Is to stay calm yourself and to try and figure out what's true and not true, and if your source is really informed or not informed. This is what happened to CNN, for example, when they reported somebody had been arrested and nobody had been arrested. It was just a poorly sourced story. Is the reporter really at fault? That's a good thing to talk about. I don't know who their source really was, but it seems like it came from someone in the local police as opposed to the FBI that was controlling the information. So it's really just to, you know, keep checking your information and make sure that whatever you do, you're not doing more damage than good reporting it.
Well, with that need to be first, not only, especially in the cable news networks and NPR too, everybody wants to get the information out there first, but of course they want to be accurate as well. How important is it to say someone's been arrested if you have it from a good source as opposed to waiting for the news conference where it's announced to everybody?
You know, I personally, I don't think it's so important. And I don't think most people think it's that important either. But, you know, there are a number of listeners and, you know, readers who will, you know, who are very drawn to the story. They're listening very avidly and they want to know the last minute stuff. But I don't personally think it's that important because it's not going to make much difference.
You talked about the concerns about the constant coverage, and I know here we aired almost all the coverage that NPR provided on WVXU. But one of the – we heard complaints really from both sides, or compliments as well, from folks that thought it was great that we had it on. They wanted to be informed. And then from other folks who said, you're just repeating the same thing and there's nothing new to tell me. Why do you keep doing that? What do you answer to that? I mean, should NPR provide that comprehensive coverage, or should it just do an update every hour?
You know, that's a management decision. That's a preference decision. That's an editorial decision, as opposed to an ombudsman decision. But I can give you my personal view, if you'd like, and that is I agree with the people who say it's too much, because I keep coming back to the point that it doesn't make any difference if we know something 5 minutes or 10 minutes sooner than if we get it, you know, on the hour with the regular news. We're not going to be able to change the events. We're not going to be able to act on this information. But human curiosity is such that we want to know, or a lot of people want to know. But I'm with the critics who say, enough already. You know, all you're doing is just repeating the same thing, and you're just keeping us all on hold and standby just in case something comes in.
And I suppose, though, in Boston, WBUR, the public radio station there, provided even more comprehensive coverage. And I suppose if you were in Boston, perhaps your interest would be far greater than it was around the rest of the country.
Of course, of course. I mean, what I'm really talking about is something happening nationally and you're not here. No, if you were here, it might be information you can act on. You want to know what's going on for your own safety, as opposed to your just mere curiosity. But it's also something happening in your neighborhood and to your neighbors. And so this is, needless to say, it's much more immediate. And that has a different level of interest.
We did invite people to send in some questions, and I want to remind you, if you'd like to ask a question of the NPR Ombudsman, Edward Schumacher Matos, you can post it on our Facebook page or email it to impact@wvxu.org. This comes from John, who says, I'd like the Ombudsman to discuss the cancellation of Talk of the Nation. This program is one of the relatively few on NPR in which the perspectives of the audience form the bulk of the program, and it seems to me that these perspectives not only deserve their place along NPR's stellar journalism, but should be valued by NPR's journalists themselves, both as an audience barometer and as news sources of considered opinion and information. 140-character tweets are no more a substitute for Talk of the Nation than commercial network sound bites are for NPR. Talk of the Nation, as we heard a few weeks ago, has been canceled as of the end of June. What are you hearing about that, and what are your thoughts on his question?
We get that complaint a lot. And many people were very attached to Talk of the Nation. I personally liked it a lot, too. I appeared on it a number of times. It was a favorite outlet for me. Again, this was another management decision, and I can understand the decision. The shows like yours, this very show that we're on, have come up since Talk of the Nation was first developed. They're excellent shows. You have very sophisticated coverage with good people that you bring onto your show. And the feeling was inside NPR that we were repeating what you and the other member stations were doing, and that we served the member stations and listeners better by doing what NPR as a national organization can do, which is to go out and do actual original reporting. Let me say that the board of NPR that made this decision is made up of primarily general managers from member stations. So this was a decision, a collective decision, and not just a decision by somebody in Washington.
We're talking with NPR's ombudsman. This question comes from Paul, who says, why aren't there any conservatives on NPR? I realize the network skews liberal, but you could make an effort at balance. Terry Gross is very liberal. E.J. Dion is very liberal. He debated David Brooks, who is moderate. He says a much better match would be E.J. Dion and someone like Charles Krauthammer, and one who would have hoped that Juan Williams' incident would have led to some reflection. And Paul believes that until NPR gets more balance, it will always be seen as lacking credibility. Your thoughts on that? I'm sure you hear complaints about the type of reporting and the slant that people either believe they hear or actually do hear in the coverage from NPR.
That's interesting, the way the listener defined everybody. I actually get more complaints today from people on the left saying that NPR is skewing conservative instead of people on the right saying it's skewing liberal, which is the old complaint. The looking at just that lineup of those commentators is not a fair way to judge NPR, number one, because if anything, NPR is reducing its number of commentators in the wake of the Juan Williams fiasco. Juan Williams was indeed very badly handled. I don't know if I'd call David Brooks just a mere moderate against E.J. Dion. To me, one is center-right and the other center-left. Krauthammer is a stronger right guy on the right and would make a strong right voice. I mean, that is true. But standing back to look at NPR's coverage overall, I don't see that it skews strongly right or strongly left. I see it really trying to stay somewhere in the middle, But I go back and make the same point again. I get far more complaints from the left now than I get from the right.
What are some of those complaints you're getting from the left? Because I've heard that, and I've shared that with others. And, of course, folks that are on the right that complain about NPR just can't believe there would be any complaints from the left. What are those complaints?
No, it's the left that, say, starts over with Ralph Nader. I don't mean the way out left. I just mean the old standard, what was center left in its day, or a little bit more to center left. But, you know, Ralph Nader liberals and many others of that persuasion, you know, who say that we take Obama and we take so many Democratic politicians as being liberal or on the left when they are in the center. In other words, what your listener said about David Brooks, these guys say about all the so-called liberals that are put on air. And so they cite, for example, healthcare as a perfect example. They say that, you know, we feel, you know, we put Obamacare up against its critics on the right, as opposed to Obamacare up against its critics on the left, who say it doesn't go anywhere near far enough.
This is
In terms of government, in terms of, you know, government intervention in the health sector.
This is Impact Cincinnati on 91.7 WVXU. I'm talking this morning with NPR's ombudsman. If you have a question or a comment, you can email us, impact@wvxu.org, or post it on our Facebook page. We're going to take a short break. We'll continue our discussion in just a moment.
Support for WVXU comes from the Mill Valley office campus, where I-71 meets downtown Cincinnati. Offering a wide variety of office space solutions with plenty of parking included, Mill Valley can help position your company for growth. For assistance with your office leasing needs, John Schenk of Colliers International can be reached at 721-4200.
Support comes from the Cincinnati Art Museum, presenting James Welling, Monograph. Influential American conceptual photographer, James Welling is featured in the most thorough presentation of the artist's work to date. James Welling, Monograph, currently at the Cincinnati Art Museum, running through May 5th. You can discover more at cincinnatiartmuseum.org.
It's 9:34. This is 91.7 WVXU. We're talking this morning with NPR's ombudsman, Edward Schumacher Matos. If you have a question for him, please email us, impact@wvxu.org, or post your question on our Facebook page. One of the things that seems to be coming out more and more is just the ethical responsibility of journalists. And one of the items that I'd like to talk about this morning are, what are the ethical guidelines that NPR has for journalists, and the whole idea of being transparent in terms of who's underwriting the program, where the money is coming from, all of those sorts of things.
Yes, you know, NPR came out with a new ethics guideline about a year and a half ago, which I think is very good. Instead of being strong rules, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, et cetera, do this, don't do that, it's principles. And the main thing is to try to be transparent, to be open, and to debate things that come up, because there's so many things that really are gray areas or things that you can't foresee. And it's just to have the right principles in mind and to know what you're doing when you do it. Reporters are supposed to always talk with their editors whenever they have any kind of a question that comes in. And the same thing happens at the management level.
Now, you do have some rules in terms of what organizations reporters can take part in and signing petitions, those sorts of things. Explain a little bit about what those rules are.
Yes, I mean, the whole idea is, again, they're not listed as hard rules. They're listed as principles that reporters have to be independent, and so they can't belong to any kind of a partisan organization. But, you know, it gets to be, how far do you go with it? I mean, say you want to join your local PTA or, you know, your local neighborhood group or something. Shouldn't you be able to do that? Well, yes, you can do that. So, You don't want to do anything that colors your reporting or that in any way defines you politically, but it doesn't mean that you totally shut yourself off from society. I think one of the ironic kickbacks that have come from the great movement in ethics and journalism is that and sometimes I wonder if we haven't taken it so far that we've cut ourselves off from our communities. We don't become part of our communities. We become, you know, separate would-be judges, and that turns into an arrogant stance. This is a very, I'm still trying to work my way through this argument, so I can't say I have it totally worked out in my mind exactly, how to draw the lines on that, but it is something that concerns me.
This question comes from Maggie, who says the recent gun debate or national conversation was extremely slanted. She says nearly daily news reports about gun violence and innocent victims of the same, but no reporting on how guns were used to defend homeowners and their families in criminal home invasion scenarios. A young widow and her infant son when two thugs attempted to break in. A couple in northern Ohio who held two armed robberies until the police arrived. And she says none of these stories were reported on NPR or, for that matter, even on our local programs. So your thoughts about the issue of the gun control?
There have been some stories from that point of view, and I've received even complaints about those stories from gun control advocates. I understand the writer's point of view, but statistically, it doesn't bear out. I mean, statistically, it's more dangerous to have a gun in the home than not have a gun in the home. So, the point of view that there are instances like that instance where one does turn out being safer having a gun, and no one is, and I don't think NPR is taking a stance that says, do away with guns in the home or do away with guns, period. But it's not taking any stance at all on the issue that I can tell, but statistically, you just can't avoid the fact in your reporting, in fact-based reporting, that it's more dangerous to have guns than not have them.
One of the things that people can do is if they have a concern, they can write to you, and we have a link to your website at our website, WVXU.org, but they can send in their questions and their concerns, and you do some investigating on that. What have you found? Have you found anything where you've really thought that NPR made a big mistake?
Yes. I mean, there have been some, I think, where they have made big mistakes in their reporting. And I'm working on one right now that I would rather not talk on the air, but there have been some in the past. It more than big mistakes are judgment calls that are parts of stories, and it's smaller mistakes within a story, or the fairness of the story could have been better. That type of a thing. I'm looking at one now, separate from the one that I think is actually a big mistake. But there's two really good issues that I'm looking at. One involves fisheries, and the second one involves people with disabilities who get, occupational disability funding, support from Social Security. And, is that being abused, or is that being over, or too many people claiming it than who deserve it, and can we afford it, and that type of a thing. And so there's been a huge, huge wave of complaints that have come in that said the NPR stories were wrong and that we were taking, that they seem to be slanted in favor of criticizing the number of people who are getting this disability support. Because as we all know, that number has really gone up and it has indeed gotten more expensive. And so, what does that mean? So there have been many meetings going back and forth between all these organizations in the newsroom, and the organization kept me in the loop. I've been following it. I've been looking at it. I can see their complaints. I can see what they're talking about. But on the other hand, I can see the newsroom side on this one too. And so it's like what you listen to at any one time in the report. Is this particular thing totally fair and accurate? Does it represent the whole story, or do you have to take the whole series? And stand back and look at what the whole series says, and judge on that as opposed to what you hear in different pieces of it. That's what I'm looking at right now. I don't have an answer on that yet, but I'm looking at it, and that's more typical of what we get instead of something that's just totally wrong.
You said you're working on another big one that you're not comfortable talking with yet. Will you be posting a column about this on your website then?
That's the problem. It's more than a column. It's so big. And when we hang up here, that's what we'll be back working on.
But,
yes.
But you're likely to do something with that.
Yes. I will.
We just heard back from Maggie, who was concerned about the gun control debate, and she said that you were wrong about the gun statistics. She's unable to cite them specifically, but she says the FBI stats say that that's not true, that more people are injured by guns in the home than protected by guns in the home. Where are your statistics from?
Oh, I don't have them here in front of me, so I don't want to get in an argument with her. This is such a heated and passionate debate, and what I just try to make sure is that her side gets reported as well as everybody else's side in this debate. That's all.
This question is from Jake, who says the ombudsman's view of left versus right and right versus wrong is symptomatic of a bigger problem with NPR. He says commercial media already occupies the space of left, right, wrong, and there's no need for NPR to distinguish its reporting through investigative and should do that through investigative and independent journalism and accuracy in words in identifying sources. How many sources? Those sorts of things. He says it's increasingly challenging to tell the difference between NPR and the Washington Post or the New York Times. And he says it's increasingly difficult to justify supporting NPR because of that. Your comments?
I'm lost. I don't quite understand what that complaint is.
I guess what he's saying is that it's the commercial media is already defining themselves as being left versus right and doesn't believe that NPR needs to distinguish itself. It should be distinguishing itself more in its reporting through investigative and independent journalism.
I think that's what NPR is trying to do, just what he thinks it should be doing. If he could point to some examples where he thinks it's not doing it, do indeed let me know. In comparison with commercial media, the problem with commercial media today is, one, he's right that it is going more identified with the point of view to the right and the left. I think that's just an inexorable trend that we see happening in the commercial news media. But secondly, it's just doing so much less reporting. It's just, there's a crisis in news media of trying to come up with a news model that's sustainable so that they can afford to do the reporting they used to do. So, thankfully we have NPR and all of the public media to try to step into the gap.
This question's from Debbie, who says, I have mixed feelings about reporters presenting themselves as experts, for example, on shows like Diane Rehm, instead of true experts, which she calls the scientists and politicians directly involved on the front lines. However, I realize the latter are often pressured or influenced or bought by powerful political influences. Wouldn't it be better for discussion panels to have a mix of reporters and inside experts? She wants your thoughts on the veracity of reporters' perspectives.
Mm-hmm. I think she's right, and I think most shows try to mix it up. You bring reporters in only to be analysts, not to be experts with an opinion on what should be done in a current situation. They can share their reporting. They can talk about what they see and how they see on the different sides, but they're not supposed to come up with a definitive judgment on something.
So you think they'll continue to use reporters as just the people that can explain the situation?
Reporters make good sources. I'm sure you find that talking to reporters is helpful for your show and for other shows. But generally speaking, you call-in shows. Diane Rehm is not actually produced by NPR. It's produced by WAMU in Washington. But, try to get the kind of experts that she wants, I think, is exactly what they try to do a lot. They just find reporters are good because oftentimes they can speak well, or they understand where the public is coming from, or they don't get so bogged down in arcane details. But the reporters are not supposed to forget that they're reporters, even when they go on air to be interviewed, when they themselves are interviewed.
I thought it was interesting. You wrote a column about the elderly and how people that are of a rising age, 60s, 70s, 80s, don't like to be referred to as the elderly. Tell us the complaints you got about that.
That's a good issue, and it's one that that many people got very passionate about. And there's no real right or wrong here. you know, as we as a nation, and as the baby boom moves into the post 65, post 60 age demographic, and is healthier than past segments of that demography. It doesn't like to think of itself as being elderly or old or aged or anything like that. And so what is the right word to use for describing that generation or people past a certain age? And at what age is the cutoff point? And this is, you know, these are all questions of social usage and what is considered acceptable or not acceptable, and not everyone is going to agree. So it's very hard to come up with the right word on this kind of a thing. And all you can do is sort of stick your finger up in the wind and see what the prevailing trends are, what offends people the least, what remains still accurate grammatically, and come up with a word. And so the one elderly is one that many people over 65 don't like, and one can understand it because there's a certain connotation that suddenly you're less vigorous, you're really retired, and that's not happening. People over 65 or over 60 or over 70 or over 75, you know, are working, are active, are healthy. They, you know, don't want to think of themselves as elderly. And I can totally sympathize with that. So it's just a matter of coming up with the right word.
Illegal immigrant is another word that's gotten a lot of debate. What's the process now? What's the right way to describe people who are in the country illegally?
Yes, that's another one that's caught in that same debate. Illegal immigrant for the longest time was seen as the neutral word. Illegal alien is in fact the legal word. That took on very bad connotations, and especially the way it was used by opponents to oftentimes to just immigration in general, but particularly to policies concerning illegal immigration. The undocumented immigrant actually started up by the Chicano movement out in California, and Chicano rights and so forth, and was considered a more radical term in its early beginnings. But it has been, that movement has long since died. But the term has slowly grown as the term of choice among, you know, advocates for immigrants, and has spread and spread throughout the society. And so that became seen not just as a political term, but as a term that was less insulting to people who lived here for years illegally and who responded to market pressures. They came here under a system that wasn't working, but they were, if they were illegal, so was all the people who hired them, and a whole system that just wasn't working. So, and that's why we're having this comprehensive immigration reform today. So then what's the right term for such a large group of people that slowly are becoming Americans? So I think that's another inexorable process we see happening today. So, you know,
I hate to interrupt,
there's
but
no good answer, right?
And we are out of time. So I appreciate your time. Hope we can have you back sometime soon.
Okay. I enjoyed it.
Thank you so much for listening to Impact Cincinnati on 91.7 WVXU. My guest today was NPR Ombudsman Edward Schumacher Matos. Archives of our programs are available on our website, wvxu.org. Producer for today's program was Pete Reitmeier.